Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. I'm happy to have our second show in a series of ongoing shows about Gibson guitars and the Gibson heritage of their line and what they've done, their iconic guitars that have influenced our music today. And returning are my very, very, very good friends, Greg and Sharon DeLordo. Welcome. It's good to have you guys back, and it's always fun because they bring so many cool things in here, and we got a bunch of guitars in here if you can look around. They're all playing really valuable guitars and really beautiful instruments, but we have some extra ones to show you. So tonight's going to be an interesting show. We're going to be talking about the ES series of guitars, a pretty iconic brand of Gibsons that were pretty famous from the 50s on to today and used by so many different musicians in many different styles. Also, too, we got some I'm very honored to have some other musicians here besides Greg and Sharon. Wolf Marshall, thanks for coming back again. He was here on the other show that we did on the L5. He's a professor at UCLA. He's also an author. Here's one of his books I'm going to show you, which we're going to talk about because one of the big guitars in the ES series was Lucille, the B.B. King guitar. So this is his book on B.B. King. Very, very cool. Am I out of range? I mean, thanks, Doug. And Doug's here to make me sure that I stay on frame. And also, too, another guitarist, collector, he's performed with, if I say the name, like Claudia Lanier.
Yeah, that's correct.
And Glenn Kishi. And again, he has a beautiful guitar. I'm just like, if I don't look green yet, I will be green with envy with these guitars. So anyway, I'm going to start off with Sharon to kind of set it up. And we got a lot to cover tonight. So we're just going to kind of storm through this. So Sharon, take it away.
Thank you. Well, as you know, usually I talk about Orville, the spirit of Orville, and what he begat. Well, this is part of his legacy. Orville, you know, he started making guitars back in the 1800s, and then he had a series of people that followed in his footsteps. And one of the most important people to follow in his footsteps was Ted McCarty. Even though Ted was not a guitarist himself, he was an engineer. And he is responsible for some of the most iconic guitars in guitar history, and that is the ES 300 series. And Heritage is part of that legacy as well. So I'm really excited when Jeff says, you know, he'll be green with envy. It really is an honor to be in the presence of these guitars and these absolutely fabulous guitarists, authors, historians, and our friends. So take it away.
All right, we'll start with Greg. Tell us the story. When did this all start?
Yeah, well, thank you, Jeff. Well, first of all, when Ted McCarty and his design team decided to come up with a version of the 30s Les Paul log guitar, which you may remember, which was the real 335 back then. And it was obvious that it had a log and wings from an acoustic guitar, and then they decided to conceal that. So you see on the guitars, you don't see anything. They look regular like archtop guitars, but there is a center block, which is 4 inches wide and an inch deep, going through the guitar. So that became the ES-300 series. And the first version of that and the most popular guitar was the 335, and it's known as the dot marker or the dot neck, as we call it today.
Go ahead and hold it up.
This is what Wolf is holding here, 1960 dot neck. This is in the traditional sunburst finish, and you can see the aged amber color around the binding. It's a Brazilian rosewood fingerboard. The neck is solid mahogany Honduras, and the pitch of the headstock is 17 degrees. That is the original pitch that they used
back in
the day. Tilts and has maximum down pressure across the nut, which gives you sustain and gives you added tension. So the guitar feels nice and tight and has sustain. It also has a stop bar tail, which is bolted right into the block, and that's where you get your tail down pressure over the bridge at approximately 7 degrees. And then the neck is pitched at approximately 5 degrees. Now, this guitar is famous for the pickups. This is the original humbucking pickups, which was designed by Seth Lover, and that is known as the PAF, patent applied for. So this guitar has all the magic. And being a 60s, it was one of the last dot necks, so it has the newer style bonnet knobs on it in opposed to the
go ahead and hold that up again.
Knobs. So it's got a lot of, it's all original. It's got the longer pick guard also on it.
So the design of the ES series, I always thought that it utilized with the solid block for obviously the sustain, and the block goes all the way down to the stop.
All the way to the
does
end.
It go to the end?
To the end. All
to the
way.
End?
Yes.
It was designed so that, because with the new amplifiers and stuff, to get the jazz sound, but still at a higher volume.
Higher volume without any of the feedback that you have on a carved top or an acoustic, exactly.
And this, the dot neck, when I was in school in the 70s, this was like the guitar back then for the session guys. I know Lee Ritenour had a dot neck, and Larry Carlton had a dot neck, and it was like the most desirable guitar.
Absolutely. And it's come that way. It's been reissued several times, and it's still being made. And those specs are the magic specs. The 24 and three quarters scale, 1/11 16ths nut width. And that's what gives the guitar its magic, along with the pickups and everything about it, just the look of the guitar. It's nitrile cellulose lacquer, three-color finish. This guitar has all the magic, and this is what is emulated with other guitar companies, including the guitars we'll show a little bit later. But basically, this is the sound, and maybe, Wolf, can you do something? The double pickup, the golden...
Let's start with the standard humbucker configuration, because this would be considered the courting jazz tone. And if you warmed it up by... It starts to sound like an archtop. But most people played it for rock and roll, so they turned up the volume a little bit more and the treble, and they got a brighter, piercing sound. When you put it in both positions, which is BB's favorite spot, you get both pickups together, and you get a more nasal sound that has a little bit more penetration. A little bit more mid, but with a different center.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is the treble position. It'd be something that probably Chuck Berry would use, because he used 335s too.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So, but the standard blues position was in the center. And that was because they like to have the pickups on at the same time and mix as they go.
Yeah, and I think actually even too, I remember at the Royal Albert Hall, I think Clapton was using one, and he would use the middle area too a lot besides the neck pickup.
That's right.
But he would get that sound. It was more...
Cuts through.
It's not an out-of-phase sound, but it has that simmer. Mm-hmm. It has the low end, but it's chimey.
Mm-hmm. I like to call it the humbucking, the golden honey tone that you get with the double pickup and the PAF.
A chord like this.
Yeah, it's got the sparkle, but it's still got the...
Yeah.
And these guitars, and especially the early 60s, and the necks are to die for. I mean, it's on the best, fastest, thinnest, slimmest necks.
Yes.
Easiest to play. I mean, every 60s, early 60s, that I've played has always just been amazing.
So. Right. Absolutely. So this is the legendary guitar. This is the iconic guitar that everything is built from. And then, of course, they went on from there to add block inlays on the fingerboard. Eventually, the pickups changed. The headstock changed for a number of reasons to 14-degree pitch, which we can talk about a little bit later.
What changed in the humbuckers?
Well, when it became, the patent was applied for long before this was introduced, so they kept the PAF tags. Then it became the patent number, and the pickups were slightly different. They started to standardize them. The first runs were pretty much custom shop. They were all a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Some were hotter than others, and some even mixed a little bit different than others. So they tried to standardize the magnet as far as the winds and the
Now, what material. Was the first year they were released? The ES series. When were they first? What was the first year they came out?
58. They were putting them out there.
And
they had been seen in 1958.
And was it just the 335, or did the 330 come out too?
It was the 335. That was the main one.
Then when did the other one come
Shortly
out?
Shortly after. Like within a year, you would see the others. And then the 45 came out. They were all kind of jumped at the same time. Within a
year. So it was that fast?
That fast. That was their investment. That was the direction they were going. They put. Like all the bets were on this horse, you know, and that's
well. Explain to everybody too, so they know the difference between the ES 330, 335, 345, 355, because those were the main ones.
The 335, as we mentioned, was just what Wolf has here. Now later on, it had a block inlay, and that's basically the cosmetic change. However, when the 45 came out, it was the same guitar, but it had dual parallelogram inlays, like a Gibson ES 175. That was Gibson's idea, except the first fret was blank. That was the difference on that guitar. It was also stereo. It had stereo and a Variatone, which we can talk about when we get to the other guitar
the
here.
King.
The BB
King,
King
has
King
that
sealed.
Standard. So that was stereo, and then the 555 came out after that, which was upgraded with an ebony...
355.
I'm sorry, 355. And ebony fingerboard block inlay. And it also had the split diamond inlay, like a Les Paul Custom or
right.
a Super 400
on the headstock.
On the headstock.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the top of the line. And then they added the Vibrola and a couple versions of the Bixby and the Gibson Vibrola and then the sideways. So they had a couple of versions of the tremolo.
Right. And also these, you'll see on here, the 335, the 345, the 330 have the single binding. And you'll see when we pull out the Lucille, which is more like the 355.
It's multi-bound.
It's multi-bound like a Les Paul Custom.
Now, the 45 had three-ply at the top. It was black, white, black. But a very
Oh, it did
fine,
have three-ply
very,
binding?
Very fine on the top, one-ply black. But it was gold hardware as well. And the other issue was the cherry finish came out around that time. And just for the note... George Goble was the first one to have the cherry finish on his L5CT that we may have mentioned on our last visit, but that color became a standard color in the ES300 series, and that's this color here. This is the 60s
Go ahead.
Cherry.
You can, even if it's inverted, just I'll show people so they can see a little more. There you go. So this is that. And if you look at the early Gibson catalogs, all the Gibsons, when I used to see in the store when I was a kid, they were mostly this cherry finish.
It became the number one color. And when we were working with Gibson, I mean, it was cherry. It was like a dealer would buy cherry because he knows that's going to sell. And it's sharp on TV and on pictures and film. And just the look of it, it's a very cool look. With the ambered yellow binding, just gives it the vintage look. This one here is like a 330. This is actually a 530. But this is a hollow guitar. That was the only one of the group that was hollow. The rest of them had the center block. But the 330... was a hollow guitar, and it had just a fine patch bracing, they call it, an inside to support it. And it had a trapeze tailpiece like this one, not a stop bar. And
yeah, but how did they mount the bridge? Because that bridge is
bolted
down.
Well, there's a half-inch brace underneath here. It's about the patch. So it's about 4 inches wide, and it goes the length of this. So it has enough to support the bridge, but not a tailpiece. Tailpiece is where the tension would be. And they would always have P90s. This one has Lawler P90s on it, but the standard Gibsons were the P90s.
And because there was no block, you can see. They're using the dog ear P90s.
Right, and they mount them from the top. And the other thing, now this one is mounted just like a 335. The neck joins the body at the 19th fret, where the standard 330 was at the 16th fret. Mm-hmm. So it was a completely different guitar. So this is what you would call a modernized 330. or a three.
I notice also too. I don't know if it's the binding. Is the 335 thicker than that guitar?
It is. This is 1 3/4. This is 1 5/8.
Now, was the original 330 one and?
No, it's always been
the same.
The heritage
version is a little narrower.
Exactly, and this is a cream binding, and this is an off-white binding that's aged. So there's a little difference in the color there.
This was
off-white when it was new.
Really, then, it wasn't cream.
No, this is aged. This is a lacquer.
Yeah, I know it's aged from the
lacquer. Some 50-60 years of aging.
Right.
But originally, it wasn't. It was white.
It was off-white. Yes.
Off-white. Yeah.
Off-white.
Sort of a pearl white.
Right.
Pearl white.
Like Glenn's here. Now, Glenn's 347. Now, this is an 80s, or actually a 78. And this is white and off-white again, and it's aged a bit. You can see as
But is that yellow. Is that cream binding?
No, this is off-white.
Off-white. So this is an off-white.
That's aged with a lacquer.
Okay. So you can actually see a little bit of a difference on it.
It's noticeable, and it gives the guitar a vibe. You know, it just gives it a look. You know, the bright white binding, we call it white lightning. It has a look, and that's what we see on the BB King, because that's more of the tuxedo look. You see that black and white, that's striking, and that shows up on film and on pictures very well. But these are vintage. They look just aged. They just have a vibe to them, you know.
So after the 330, 340, 335, 345, 355,
mm-hmm.
Then there's a bunch of other ones like this one, the 3-4. When did these all come out?
This came out basically as a guitar in between the 335 because the BB King was coming out in 1980. So this was coming out in a couple years before it, the 347. And this had all the specs and features of the BB King except for the stereo and the closed F-holes. So this is the standard configuration. They're all maple back and maple tops with sandwiched poplar wood in between, so it's a laminate, it's not a plywood. People understand that. It's a three-ply laminate. The rims are maple. The neck on this is maple. And the neck on the BB King.
The whole neck is maple.
And that's what gives you the brilliance and sustain. And what they did further to add the brilliance on these guitars, which would be evident on the BB King, is they added a brass nut, ebony fingerboard, and they have 5/8 brass studs underneath the tune-o-matic bridge to give it a little more lift. And they also had super humbuckings in it, which were a very bright and hot pickup, which we ended up changing for Duncan 59s to give it that warm sound.
Now, that has a solid block all the way down?
Yes, solid block. Same construction.
Okay, now you have two toggles. What's going on with the toggles?
This one's a coil splitter, I believe.
Right, this was a coil tap, and these Duncans that we put on were standard wires, so we bypassed that.
Okay, so is that toggle is just on and off, split or not.
Exactly. And that can be revived.
I thought
easily.
They had push-pull pots where they would, like on the treble, where it would
we
bypass the electronics?
At Heritage, we did push-pulls. And that seems to be the more modern way to do it.
Okay, because a friend of mine had the push-pull, I think, on his 347.
They make really nice push-pull pots now, and they weren't available back in the day at a high quality with the low resistance, like 250. And
so that's what is that just a single binding? I can't. It's hard to see, but the top, the headstock has the tri-binding.
I can't see it. That's standard like a 555 binding, and then of course the Gibson Crown.
Yeah, the Crown.
This one has Schallers, and this was one of the first guitars when they started to make the maple necks. You can slide sideways. You see the volute. This one has the volute on it.
Go ahead and turn it around.
And this was because they were having such problems with breakage in the case and without the case. So that's when they cranked the headstock back to 14 degrees from 17. So this is a 14-degree headstock, maple neck, three-piece, with the volute. And this gave it the added rigidity that it needed and the safety because it falls. However, nobody liked it. The guitar players, rejected that. They didn't like the feel of it, even though violins have had it for years and it's a standard part of guitar making.
Glenn likes it.
And I liked it. I didn't have any issue with it.
I couldn't afford a dot neck at the time. So,
that was a big thing, especially traveling and stuff. They would snap.
That's right. The cases back in the day weren't that great. And we were talking on the way up here in the car that a lot of the breakage was due in the case because the back of the headstock here would actually touch the bottom of the case because the neck brace in the case was not correct. So the guitar would fall over in the case and it could crack the neck at that point.
Yeah.
So now that's all been corrected. The new cases have the right.
So what year did this come out?
78.
1978.
And can I interject one thing to
yes,
add to this?
Absolutely.
I had a 77 ES-335 that was walnut, and it had the coil splitter and went to the trapeze tailpiece, as well as a little blocks. So what happened in the evolution of the 335 is they got away from the dots, went to little blocks, eventually went to trapeze, and then put a coil splitter on by 77, 78.
In the later 60s, like 66, you saw more trapeze than you saw.
65, they started the trapeze. It was my first 345 was a 65, and that came with that stock.
And they added the walnut color.
And that was great.
About 70?
About that, actually before that, 65. That
65,
was available.
Okay, walnut.
One thing I didn't mention to say is we were talking about the metals being brass, steel, titanium, or aluminum. Those are tone-producing metals. And every part of the guitar has to ring and be resonant, and that's what they use. That's part of the sweetness of the older guitars. As the evolution of the guitar moved on, they started using metals that weren't pure metals. So the tailpiece, for example, this one is a brass tailpiece. So even though it's the traditional tailpiece, it's actually brass and nickel-plated, in opposed to the pop metal style that they used later on. So the guitar has a nice tone to it, and tone continues through the metal parts.
Right, but what did they use in the 60s? What was it just?
Pot style.
But it wasn't brass or anything like that?
No, that was later. They updated.
And I noticed that these guitars, all of them have metal bridge pieces.
Mm-hmm.
When did they start using the plastic ones? I've seen plastic. I have them on my Les Paul.
My 65, 345 had plastic, and that was a little after this era here, the 60s. They started experimenting. They also used nylon in some of the nuts on some of the guitars for a while. So they were doing some experimenting.
What is this?
That's bone.
That is bone.
Yeah, and that's
is that bone?
Bone.
And that one? Oh, that's brass. Okay, and the BB Lucille is bone?
This one is bone here, yes. But it did have brass from the beginning. They did a change with that.
Oh, it was originally brass. Okay.
So when the BB King came out in 1980, I was fortunate enough to be with Gibson during that time. And the first show that I did at NAMM in 1981, we introduced the BB King Lucille. And I had number 4 of the Lucille, so we showed it to everybody. We sold the guitar. And the guitar was outstanding. It had PAFs on it. It had a brass nut, and the F-holes were closed. And it had the stereo, but in opposed to the stereo, the 345 or the 55 had, it had two inputs. It had one mono.
Maybe I should show that, huh?
And yeah, one. Yeah,
you can go ahead and switch real quick, and then I'm going to ask you to talk before we get more into that guitar. I want to talk a little bit about BB's evolution of what he used, because he obviously had a .NET.
Absolutely.
At some point, and then he went to the, and then, so it'll kind of set up why this guitar was made and what's the significance.
The BB King actually used several guitars, mainly Gibson, of course, but we've seen it with an L5 with P90s, we've seen them with an ES5 and other older model Gibsons, as well as .NECs, Block NECs, and
355s. So he originally was using the 335 when it came out, but then when did he go to the 355?
Not long after that.
Mid 63, 64, because the famous recording session for CBS, I believe, that he did shows him with the .NEC with a Bigsby still. And that's a pretty well-known session. There's a lot of pictures of that in his King of the Blues box set.
Original Lucille, there was an original, what was it, 355, right?
No, it was a hollow body archtop guitar. That he had way back in the 40s.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Was it a Gibson?
Yeah, it was probably like an L50 or something. Something like that, yeah. And it had a floating de-armored pickup, which he told me personally that, boy, that was a rough guitar to play compared to what he had later.
Mm-hmm.
He came up through the ranks because he played archtops in the 50s. An ES5, a Birdland, and as well as an ES-175.
Yeah, I've seen him with a Birdland.
Yeah.
Mainly the 355 is what I always see.
Well, yeah, that's later.
That's what he's doing.
Because he did have the 335 first for a number of years, And then he switched to a, he played a 330 for a while, too.
I believe there's a picture.
Yeah, there's a picture of him in New York, I think, at 63. And then he went to a 355.
Yeah, I did see the L5, P90s.
Mm-hmm.
So he used the 355. When did he go to the, when did the Lucille model come to being? When did that happen?
Well, the actual Lucille was introduced in, the Lucille was introduced in 1981. And it was put out, we have a copy of the, I think the GPI magazine, September of 80, shows him on the cover in an interview with him with his first B.B. King Lucille, which is closed F-holes.
Yeah, no F-holes, okay.
TP6, okay. Fine tuners.
But you might want to hold this up so they can see this while you're talking about it.
So these are the fine tuner wheels.
Right.
And it's, of course, a stereo with a baritone. And if you saw the side of the guitar, you see the two inputs. Yes. One is mono, one is stereo. So you can play like Wolf is playing now with one chord. And if you want to play stereo instead of a Y chord and going through all the trouble that that caused and issues, you have two chords, two amps, or two channels. Mm-hmm. And it works very cool.
Yeah.
Pickups would be PIFs. It has the tortoise shell or L5 Super 400 style multi-bound pickguard. And, of course, first-rate cosmetics, multi-bound throughout, top, back. And then the headstock is the custom, what they call the SP2 peg head, the wider peg head style, like an L5. It's got Lucille on it, a brass truss rod cover that says B.B. King. And the tuners would be Schaller M6 with Gibson Keystone buttons.
What's the there must have been a model number for this, ES what?
This was just the
called the Lucille?
B.B. King Lucille, the B.B. King Lucille.
Originally was called the B.B. King Custom.
Custom, yeah.
Then it became,
the Custom. They made a standard, which was a dressed down from this, and didn't have a baritone.
Well, let's take a listen. Now, what happens with the baritone? Because this is the same circuit in the 345s
exactly.
And the 355. So who wants to explain to me?
Well, this is the stock Gibson sound with no variation. Turn it down a little bit. Now go to the first position change on this little rotary wheel, and it's going to sound a little different. So that I have to turn up. It's a little gain. So let's go to number two. Now number three. Seems to get a little hollower.
And number three, by the way, was BB's.
Yeah, that's his setting.
Both pickups wide open, number three position.
Which I can't do.
And that's what he used on the 355 too?
Yes.
The three.
Yeah.
Okay.
So continuing on, I'll play the same phrase again. Almost the same, but with a little more treble.
Sounds like it's more of the bridge pickup.
Yeah. And finally, almost sounds like you're going through a wah.
So it sounds to me like they're using different resistors to change, they're filtering in there.
Yeah, definitely filtered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it and it's you're using it right now with both pickups.
Mm-hmm.
Go through real quick. You don't need to change the volume. Keep it. It doesn't matter if it dips. But go through with the neck pickup and then the other one, so you can hear the same thing.
Phrase. Play the same thing.
Okay, and then do it with the bridge pickup.
Okay, let's go all the way back towards bypass. Let me go over here. Still a little too loud. Lower. Okay, same thing here now.
It's really a major difference, even on each pickup individually, as opposed to both.
Mm-hmm. So that's the story of the baritone.
When did the baritone come out on the Gibsons? Because I know the early...
That was 59 on the 345.
345 was the first.
The first, not the 55?
355, they came later, didn't
they?
And some were without baritone.
Yeah, some, they made the 55 without, sorry, they made the 55 without the stereo.
Yeah, I remember that there was a few of them. I know that Keith Richards, he plays one without
the
baritone.
The 45 were all the same. They all had stereo.
They had the stereo. But it only had the one plug. You always had to use the Y cable.
Yeah, had to.
Unless you had it wired to mono.
Right, which but
that came out then, and that was, it was interesting that that was developed that early on.
Well, they also made a stereo amp that worked with that. That was kind of a cool thing for their time.
It should be mentioned, though, Hank Garland was the fellow that helped design and troubleshoot the 345 tone circuit. Mm-hmm. And there, he had a bass, six-string bass made, as well as a 345 that he used in recording sessions. A famous session guitar player played on Elvis's Little Sister and a whole bunch of other tunes, Roy Orbison stuff, Patsy Cline, all that stuff. And he was one of the famous users of 345. He's famous because he made the first thin line, which was the Birdland.
Right.
That was his model.
Oh, the Birdland?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was Garland.
And Garland, Billy Bird.
Billy Bird.
Billy Bird. I thought it was Billy Bird.
It was Birdland.
Oh, okay,
Birdland. Collaboration between the two.
Yeah.
Which is
that's interesting. Yeah,
it was thin, so there's thinness coming.
Yeah, yeah, it was, but with the smaller scale.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's interesting.
That's really. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a lot of history in this. This isn't willy nilly. A lot of people think they just came up with an idea, and sometimes they did do that. But these guitars went through a lot. They even had on the early L5 CTs, which were also made during the Birdland era. They had the baritone on those. That was kind of a
On the L5.
So they even had them on the thin L5s. So it was quite a thing there at the time. So anyway, it's very versatile. You can get a lot of tones right off the guitar, and it's a really great thing, and B.B. King's known for that.
You know, I'd like to just interject a little bit about a little history here. The ES 300 series, really, we really should thank Leo Fender. Because had it not been that one of the most wonderful competitions in guitar history, that was the competition between Leo Fender and Ted McCarty. And Leo had come out with a Strat Telecaster, and Ted is relatively new to Gibson, and he had to play catch-up. He was not going to let someone else have all the glory, even though he came from Wurlitzer pianos and was not a player of guitars. He was a very competitive person.
Let's talk a little bit about Mr. McCarty. He came into Gibson at what time? When did he join Gibson?
1948.
Mm-hmm. So what was the first thing that he brought to the table?
He brought his background, not in guitars, but he was a salesman. He was a sales genius for Wurlitzer. And we really need to thank Berlin for that, because he owned CMI at the time, and he knew McCarty was going to be leaving Wurlitzer, and CMI owned Wurlitzer. He knew Ted was going to be going to Brock's Music. I mean, excuse me, Brock's Candy. He was going to be, the CEO or president of Brock's Candy. Can you imagine what we would be missing out on if Ted had gone and made candy? Mm-hmm. It's like, yikes. We would have missed some really wonderful guitars.
Although his guitar designs were sweet.
Oh, absolutely.
But what was the first design that he did? The ES?
Was it the Flying V or stuff like that?
Well, that came later. The Flying V and the Explorer and even the Modurin, that was an answer to Fender's modernistic guitars. And also the Sputnik was launched. It was kind of interesting that we just had the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, but it was in, a kind of a response to the Sputnik that was launched. They decided to make something far out, so they ended up with the V, the Explorer, and then the Modurin was on the drawing board when the whole thing, went down because it wasn't selling at the time. Now, of course, you'd be lucky to even find one. But that was the competition. The solid
So he designed
guitar.
The Flying V, the Explorer,
and
then
the
Modern.
Yes.
Did they ever release them on? There's been
no.
a lot of
no,
speculation that they actually had
no,
them for
they
sale.
Never had. They never had one. And there is that story out there, and it's one of the conspiracy stories, but no one's ever seen it. But there is the drawing and the diagrams that you see in
Well, they've made
the
one now, like a
replica. Yeah, they, in the 80s, we reissued it when I was with Gibson at that time, and we sold several of them, actually. There was a limited edition. I think they did 100 of them nationwide, and we sold them.
And those were Carina, right?
Carina
Wood.
Right, and so were the Vs and the Explorers. That was all Carina back in the day.
So that was his first contribution. When were those? When did those come out?
That was the 60s, I believe.
No, they were 58.
I'm sorry, 58.
Flying V was in 58, which yeah. means it was designed in 57 to be put in production by 58.
So I'm trying to get a timeline. He comes on board. He came on board when? In 1940?
In 1948, and he was with Gibson for 16 years. And then he went off to do the Bixby, mm-hmm. and he did that for several years, probably longer there than he was with Gibson. And then he went and he was endorsing for PRS.
So all of the stuff that he was developing kind of came out at the same time at the late 50s.
He also was responsible for the ABR1. I believe his name is on that patent. ABR1 bridge.
That's the bridge.
The Tunematic.
The Tunematic bridge.
First Tunematic.
When did that come out?
Well, that came out. That was on all of the guitars as early as 54, I believe. I'm going to say 54. The Black Beauty. That came on the Black
so
Beauty.
So that was the first thing he contributed mm-hmm. to. I'm trying to figure out mm-hmm. what he first, after getting there, mm-hmm. what was the first thing that he did? Because it was a very fertile time for him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, you know, he's coming out of the, you know, post-World War II, and so Gibson was needing to energize. The company had been sold in 1944 to CMI, and, you know, they knew they had something hot in Kalamazoo, and they just needed somebody really to go in and, you know, manage it properly, and... I just think that CMI, you know, they were just, so there was
well,
so
what
much
was,
wisdom.
What was his title? He was a design guy or was he a marketing guy?
President.
He was president
of Gibson. In fact, when I get asked questions, you know, when I tell people I'm working on history, on Gibson guitar and heritage guitar history, Ted McCarty is the first name that comes up. And I'm going to change that because I do want Orville's name, Orville H. Gibson, to be the first name people think of. But I would say the majority of the time people think of Ted McCarty because they are thinking about this, the ES-300 series. That's, you know, they know the B.B. King, Chuck Berry. And so that's really what he, and he himself, with all of the things that he designed and he was responsible for, he thought his own crowning achievement was this series. So I would say.
So it was his. It was his. Mm-hmm. Because it's interesting. You got to look at the. You look at the 50s, and rock and roll was coming in. The Les Paul wasn't as popular. It was more of these type of guitars. We did see some of the newer acts were in the late 50s. I guess it's interesting because like with Elvis, Scotty used a big semi. Yeah, he used the jazz guitars. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the rock and rollers at the time, even I think Bill Haley and those guys were using the big guitars. They weren't using the little guitars. Mm-hmm. Or some of the guys that came out at that time were using the Gretches, the semi-hollow mm-hmm. or hollow Gretches. So it's interesting to see that. Now, at the turn, besides the blues guys, this guitar became the 335 was the guitar that... I think it was Noki from the Ventures. That's what he used.
Yep.
And a lot of the sessions that were used, you know, Tedesco did use a Fender, but a lot of times they use the ES series for a lot of the rock and roll. Mm-hmm. Carl Wilson used a 335.
Well, we had mentioned that when we were in one of our sessions that, you know, the Les Paul's a very, very famous guitar, and everybody attributes that to the most popular. However, all styles of music, you know, these guitars fit in that, and they're used from everything to country, you know, all kinds of country versions of the rockabilly, even jazz players. As a matter of fact, this model, this hollow body, is very widely used. It was the number one seller back then, and one of the reasons was it was known as the student model, the lesser price model of the group, but also it was very usable for jazz people or traveling musicians that wanted to sound and not having to lose the tone.
Right. Well, the ES series, especially later in the 60s, early in the 70s, was like the de facto fusion. Mm-hmm. Almost every jazz rock guy was mm-hmm. using, and all the session guys were using. Of course, Larry Carlton brought it to, you know, it became right. a big thing. But there was other guys, a lot of the British guys, the Hollies, they used mm-hmm. They used the ES 335, 345. I remember mm-hmm. seeing him playing a 345.
Mamas and the Papas. And
the Beatles.
The Beatles, right?
Right.
Everybody.
Keith Richards
mm-hmm. used them too, besides the Les Paul. He used those. Yeah, they were really popular. So by the time the 60s, the rock and roll thing had really flourished in the British Invasion, mm-hmm. they were like, you know, I mean, there's just so many people that use
everybody.
These guitars.
I mean, the blues people were coming out, you know, towards the end of the 60s there, and you saw 335s and 345s with everybody that were using those guitars. Johnny Rivers, you know, mm-hmm. all kinds of people that would use the guitar. It's a guitar for all occasions.
Berry.
Chuck Berry, of course.
Well, Chuck Berry, yeah. You know? But, I mean, you had all these, the Jefferson Airplane were using mm-hmm. it.
Oh, yeah.
All the those guys, oh, yeah. the Grateful Dead, used a lot of this, mm-hmm. the ES. You the saw sound. Them everywhere. It started, became very prevalent.
The sound, it just has a warm sound to it, and it cuts through. They're easy to hold, comfortable to play, very stable, and just became the guitar, like I say, of all occasions.
Now, when did the other variations, you know, we already talked about the 347, and you mentioned this one, which is the 336, but this yeah. is a later one.
That's, I believe, one of the first ones there.
When did that come?
I mean, as far as that smaller body.
Now, I'm going to mention this one. Now, this is an Epiphone version, and this is mine, and it's been heavily modified, but this is an ES-339. So it's basically a 335, and this is a dot neck, but it's the smaller body. Now, this one I've changed. These pickups are Aero pickups, which you'll hear about later in another show, because this was set up for a show. And I don't have the Tune-O-Matic. I have the Schaller bridge, and this is a Bigsby on here. But it's all maple laminate, like the 335, mahogany neck, and it has a rosewood fingerboard. But this is that smaller body, and now they just came out. I just saw an advertisement. There's a Joan Jett model now that's an ES-339. So this was another one that was later. But when did this come out? Do you remember what year?
I'm not sure when that particular style came out, but I know this one that you held up first, that was in the 80s still, late.
This was in the
late 80s. And that had the headstock like the Pat Martino.
I think this
style.
Came out later. This had to be
I think
in
it
the
was
90s.
Later. Yeah. And that is actually more patterned to the Gibson style because it's got like a mahogany neck and it's got a maple body. And that's what we were talking earlier about, that the Gibsons were all mahogany bodies with maple caps like a Les Paul. So they're actually more solid guitars than they are.
Yeah, no, most of these
block.
That I've seen of the three, these
this is
maple.
Yeah, that's center block.
There's
style.
A block in there.
Mm-hmm.
There is a block inside here. It's full F holes, and again, it's similar to the. It's not quite the '60s neck. It's a little more rounded, but it's a nice thin neck. And you can see there's no, I forget what you call
volute.
That.
No volute.
No volute on it, mm-hmm. but it plays really well. It's a great guitar, and with these pickups, it sounds really good. But the this is a newer one. I think this was made a few years ago, about mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years ago. And it's a Gibson Epiphone. So mm-hmm. it's the mm-hmm. same body.
Well, a lot of the smaller bodies really became popular Just recently, because they're easy to carry around, some people travel. I know our friend Steve Pfister travels a lot, and he was with a 345 for a long time, but he needed a smaller guitar to fit in the overhead, you know, on a plane, for example. And then they just became more comfortable. And then we had a large influx, you mentioned Joan Jett, of women and girls playing these guitars, playing lead guitar, and they need smaller guitars.
Yeah, well, Joan used to use a Les Paul a lot, right. But
they're too heavy, though.
But this guitar, yeah, no, and then Steve, he has his Live Bullets album is specifically is a 335 that he uses, and he likes the trapeze mm-hmm. bridge, right. Or the tailpiece. He likes it, the sound of that.
There's a sound and a feel to it.
Yeah, it's a little different than the stop. Mm-hmm. So most people like the stop because of the extra sustain and
extra
stuff.
Extra sustain, right, exactly.
So it's mm-hmm. an interesting sound. Now, what about let's talk because we're almost out of time.
Right. What I wanted to do with this guitar, this was the 30th anniversary that Heritage made. This was their model. They made 30 of these. It's the top of the line of 555, which would be like the 355 we talked about. Top of the line cosmetics. This one has 59 Duncans on it.
Mm-hmm.
It has, now this is where it gets to the specs a little bit. It's got a shaller, a brass tunematic. And a shallow brass stop bar. So there's your resident metals. This one's ebony fingerboard. The neck is one piece mahogany with 17 degree headstock pitch. Body is maple again with the sandwiched.
And that's
mahogany.
The white binding,
right?
Like
this
BB
is your white
from
tuxedo.
The yeah.
Exactly. This one is translucent black.
And it's
a triple bound, right?
That's beautiful wood. Now, that's thinner than the standard Gibson.
Right, 1 5/8, and Gibson is 1 3/4.
And then what's in the inlay? They have special
inlay.
Now,
this one is different. This one's actually signed and has the owner and founder's names, Jim Derlew, Marvin Lamb, J.P. Motes, and Bill Page in the inlay pattern.
And then Kalamazoo,
30th anniversary. And an ebony fingerboard, and traditional tone and volume configuration.
And they're standard PAFs?
Standard. This one is Duncan 59s.
Duncan 59s. So
and then this one has shallower again, vintage M6, which are like the Grover Rotomatics, with ebony buttons, and a pearl truss rod cover. So this guitar is a limited edition, but the reason we brought this is the top of the line, and this incorporates everything that Dotneck had as far as the specs, the measurements. Even the Mickey Mouse here is the same spec and the neck measurements.
So yeah, no, so that's basically a 355.
Right, exactly.
But I have to mention to their credit, that's a flame maple
yes.
top and back, which is
yes.
really beautiful.
Yeah, translucent black, they call it.
I mean, even my 339, it's more of a standard just maple. They use maple, but if I'm correct, they were laminate
yeah.
maple, right?
Yeah, they're all laminate. And that's the laminate poplar.
Is that solid?
No, that's just laminate.
It is laminate.
And the other is the translucent black, but these are numbered, and this one is signed by all the guys at the factory and numbered 7, and Sharon was able to arrange that, you know.
I wanted number 1, but I had to take
that's
my
tough.
Place
that's
in line.
Tough.
So we
and
got 7.
And they said we'd get one. We don't know what or when, and it showed up the only translucent black and number 7. So we're keeping this one. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're out of time, and
can I just do a shout out?
Yeah,
I just want to let people know that Gibson Brands Inc. today, check them out because they are. I mean, you can't go and buy these guitars right now without paying an arm and a leg, but what you can do is check out the Gibson Historic Collection. And they're reviving some of these iconic guitars, and not just in the Gibson under the Gibson. Brand or label, but also Epiphone. So really check them out because we have a new Gibson has a new CEO, and the way that Ted McCarty really made a difference in the company in infusing it, I think that we're on that track.
Well, I have a quick question. When did Gibson acquire Epiphone?
That was in the 60s. I don't know exactly now, when, but by 68, they were in production.
Was the Casino made as an offshoot of the ES-330? Because now that was a fully hollow. There was no
yes.
there was no block in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, Casino and the
Sheridan. Because that's obviously the one that was John Lennon's guitar.
Riviera, right.
Sure.
Yeah, they just had names instead of numbers. But
did that come after Gibson acquired them, or was that from an earlier line of Epiphones?
Those names were already attached to them, and then they just augmented that when they picked up that line.
But the casino was a casino at that time? Because that's an interesting...
As far as I know.
It's very similar to the ES-330.
Oh, yeah, they're the same. As a matter of fact, they were making them side by side in the day.
Yeah. So, well, listen, we're out of time. I just want to mention Wolf's book. You want to check this out. There's some really cool stuff in here where he looks at B.B. King, the definitive collection. And he goes into analysis of some of them. There's some songs. There's a disc in here you can play to it, so you can actually play the stuff with a rhythm section behind you, which is very, very, That's very cool.
And it has the demonstration of the solos as well.
Yes. So he explains. And, I mean, it's written out. So, yes.
It has tablature.
Yes. But it has the notes, too, so you can see all of it. It's really, really well done. So B.B. King, the definitive collection.
Well, he liked it.
that's always a good thing. That's always a good. But anyway, Chet, that's on Hal Leonard. So you can check out Hal Leonard. I want to thank you guys so much. Greg, give your website.
GregDelordo.com.
We know who runs the website in that family. Okay. No, anyway, thank you so much. And I just want, let's do a shout out in August.
August 19th, that will be the 101st anniversary since Orville's death. And so we will be doing another tribute show to him. And we will have Greg Miner. And if people don't know Greg Miner, he put together one of the most amazing harp guitar exhibits at NAMM, at the Museum of Making Music, and it was outstanding. And he will have a harp guitar, and who knows what other goodies he may have.
Yes, so be. And then we're going to be doing, this is an ongoing thing, so we're going to be doing more of the Gibson line. There's plenty more guitars we haven't even covered. There's all sorts of interesting guitars, so we're going to keep going through all the different ones. And these guys are great because they have all of them, so we can actually show them. But anyway, thank you again.
Thank you,
Glenn, you didn't get to talk much, but
no worries.
And Sharon, it's always great to have
you
and Greg back. And Doug, you can't have that guitar. Thanks for showing
up. But it matches your shirt.
It matches your shirt. Anyway, they're going to take us out, and you guys going to play The Thrill Is Gone?
Yeah.
So anyway, everybody have a good night. We'll have them take us out, and we will see you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.